I'm really glad that you could all be here. And just for those of you who don't know me, I'm Jo Handelsman. I'm the Associate Director of OSTP, and I run the Division of Science. And it's just an absolute pleasure to be here for this event today, and a delight to have so many of you here, and so many of you making quite generous and exciting commitments that I think will change the future of the microbiome. I just wanted to mention a couple of very special people and representatives of special agencies. First of all, we have Congresswoman Louise Slaughter here, who will be talking next, so I won't say more about her. And we're just so thrilled to have her support for microbiology, and I'll tell you why she's so supportive of microbiology if you don't know. Later. And we have Department of Energy, we have NASA, we have NSF. If the representatives are here already, perhaps you could stand just so people know you. They won't be complaining about unfunded grants, we promise. We have NIH, National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we have quite a bit of representation from the agencies, and you'll be hearing more from the federal agencies later. We also have representatives of academia, from the private sector, and philanthropic foundations who have all made tremendous commitments that will change microbiome science and I think change all of the way that all of us do microbiome science. And then finally, we'll be ending the day with Craig Venter, who is everything genomics, including the microbiome. And I think he will also share thoughts about what the future of the microbiome looks like. So I think it's really a great slate. I also wanted to mention the professional societies. American Society for Microbiology and the American Chemical Society are both represented here. And I wanted to thank them for their ongoing support of initiatives from the White House. As I'm sure you can imagine, we need to work with many different people, but the professional societies have a very special place, and they're very important for launching our initiatives because they often play an intermediary role with the scientific community, and so we want to thank them for their role. So I wanted to tell you a little bit today about the microbiome, National Microbiome Initiative, and where it came from. But I wanted to start with a definition of microbiomes, at least as we're using it in the White House, and I think most of the community will agree with this, that the microbiome is a collection of microorganisms living in a particular habitat. And we know that those habitats are quite varied, and microbes live in essentially every habitat on Earth. And really, the last 10 years has given us an appreciation of just how widespread the microbial world is, just how diverse it is, and how essential it is to the world around us and to ourselves. And so it's really that understanding that came to ahead in the White House initiative. So I'll talk about how that happened, the origins of the initiative, its goals, the commitments we are announcing, and then what we're going to do this afternoon. So the president has many science priorities, and he has, from the very beginning of the administration, been an advocate for science at all levels, in all areas. And some of his top priorities are very much furthered by the microbiome and need attention from the microbiome. So precision medicine he launched on January 30th, 2015. He's worked on alternative energy from the beginning of his administration. Agriculture is has been an area of support. You probably heard about the attempt in the president's budget to double the competitive grants budget for the Department of Agriculture. And certainly climate change is deeply influenced by the microbiome. So there's a very strong intersection of the microbiome with the science that is very high visibility in the White House already. Also, the microbiome represents an area for economic growth, and I think we've seen that particularly in the last couple of years where new companies have sprouted up across the country, and some very, very successful ones and some that have been valued at very high levels. Getting feedback, sorry. So we think that it's a microbial future. The country will depend on having great technologies and innovation in microorganisms and the science around them to grow, as the president hopes we will, and will continue to do so beyond his administration. So there was some interest in the microbiome when I arrived. I had actually met someone from the White House who was working on the microbiome at a scientific microbiome meeting long before I ever came here or even thought about coming here. So this is an interest that goes way back. But about 2 years ago, we started talking about it quite seriously. And then Elizabeth Stolberg, who many of you know, convened quite a few of our federal partners, the departments and agencies, with representatives who are knowledgeable and interested in supporting the microbiome. And so that group, it's called an FTAC, a Fast Track Action Committee, that group prepared a report that is available online, the FTAC report on the microbiome, that lays out what we know about the inventory, what the various agencies are funding and how much. And it also lays out a roadmap for some of the gaps that need to be filled in future research. At the same time, we convened a number of groups of scientists at the White House to talk about the science of microbiomes. And we had kind of overlapping groups, but different groups at different points in the process. So we covered a lot of the scientific area, fields. And we didn't just have microbiologists. We had physicists and technologists and computer scientists and people who we think are going to be our future key collaborators in the field of the microbiome, that it is going to be these interdisciplinary discussions that will probably lead to the big innovations and the creative solutions. So those meetings gave us a lot of information, a lot of ideas, and converged very strikingly with what the federal agencies were telling us. So the last thing we did was to issue a request for information in the Federal Register, and that was to get information from the public, public broadly, about what people see as what's next, what's the future of the microbiome. So from these three processes, we found a number of themes kept coming up, and they were that people were raising similar questions across all habitats where microbiomes live. And so one of the questions that we heard over and over is, what is a healthy microbiome and how do we know? Whether it was an ocean site or the human gut or some other microbiome, we don't really have a good definition of healthy, and that's something that we need. We also need technology, and the technology needs came up repeatedly in these discussions. We need technologies to detect and measure and model in multiple dimensions in space and time the communities that we're studying. We need better and bigger computational power, and we need to be able to develop complex models that take into account all of the behaviors of microbial communities and all these parameters that hopefully technology will give us the means to measure. And then finally, we heard some talk about applications, that clearly applications are critical. Ultimately, the promise of the microbiome has to be realized. And there were two questions that came up, that we don't really have good tools to alter microbiomes. And altering the microbiome is clearly going to be part of applications. That's what we will want to do. We'll want to fix dysfunctional microbiomes or protect microbiomes, and that will mean changing characteristics. And we heard over and over, we just don't have the means to do that now, and we need more knowledge in order to do it. The second one is robustness, which is includes a number of things, including the resistance of a microbiome to change. And that was brought up repeatedly as one of the big challenges that we need to pursue and understand. Why are microbial communities so resistant to change? Some of them aren't. Some of them actually are vulnerable. And why is that as well? So these were some of the issues that were brought up. And I repeat them here because I think these are core elements scientifically of the National Microbiome Initiative. And these are not new questions in microbiology. So if we look back to Metchnikoff at the turn of the 19th century, probably the microbiologists in the room all know the story of how he consumed liters and liters of yogurt with active lactobacillus cultures in it. And he found that his microbiome changed and he had lactobacillus present in his microbiome. But as soon as he stopped eating the yogurt, the lactobacillus disappeared. So this showed, once again, this resistance and recovery or resilience of microbiomes, that it's not very easy to change them in a permanent way. And so there's certainly more to learn there, and that was a theme we heard from the scientists. So the goals of the initiative are to address fundamental questions that span multiple microbiomes, develop platform technologies for studying many microbiomes, and then develop a workforce that can do this job and also can expand our current workforce to tackle more and different environments than we can study with just the regular scientific community. So in the past, the government has invested, I think, more than many of us expected. We found that in the three fiscal years of 2012 to 2014, there was $900 million of funding. Today, we're announcing an additional $120 million from the federal agencies, and you have probably seen that. If you haven't, you should look at the fact sheet, which is on our website. And that will tell you all of the very exciting new programs that the agencies are developing in answer to the call to look across microbiomes, find fundamental principles, and build new tools. And then we're also announcing a total of $400 million in new commitments from non-government groups, and that includes academia. We have some very exciting programs in there about new centers and new faculty positions in academia. Certainly industry, the private sector has a large investment and there's a lot going forward, and the private foundations have been very active in this area and will continue to be and seem to be expanding their efforts. So we're very excited. We think this is a good influx of funds and commitments that go beyond just the monetary commitments, commitments to do many things with the microbiome, give it visibility, give it a good scientific base, and then train new students. So today we're going to have panels and lightning talks. We're going to present things very quickly. You're going to hear from quite a few people and only for a couple of minutes in most cases. So we'll start with just a few exciting discoveries about the microbiome that have come recently. We'll talk about the federal agencies, and they'll tell us what they're launching as of today and some of the new directions that they're taking. We'll have a session to think about the tools that would really make a difference so that hopefully everyone here begins to think about how we invent those. And then we'll have a session on engaging the public and students, and we'll end with Craig Venter's perspective that will cover the history and the future of the microbiome. But before we turn to that agenda, I'd like to introduce Congresswoman Slaughter, who is personally one of my very favorite people. She is one of the few scientists in the Congress, and she is the only trained microbiologist in the Congress. She represents a district in Buffalo, New York, and she has consistently, just adamantly, supported all efforts to control the misuse and overuse of antibiotics, and that goes back many, many years before most of the rest of the world was talking about that issue. And so I really respect and appreciate the great work that she's done and her interest in the microbiome and her interest in being here today. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to Congresswoman Slaughter.
Good afternoon. I'm so happy to be here and so pleased with our hostesses this afternoon for asking me to be a part of this group. It is terribly exciting to me what you're doing here because we worked 14 years, if you don't know it, to get GINA passed, genetic non-discrimination, because a lot of my colleagues thought we were talking about cloning. A lot of them didn't have any idea what cloning was, so that we had several troubles. So I've always been extraordinarily grateful to Craig Venter because he went door to door with me in the United States Senate looking for support. He was so great. Martin Blaser has been such a close friend of mine. It was Martin that showed me that while I'm trying to save antibiotics, that sometimes they caused harm. And I'm really personally excited about this. I'm so glad it's funded well and all the enthusiasm is there for it. Because ever since I learned that agriculture used antibiotics to make animals fat, I couldn't help but wonder if it did the same thing for humans. And since we've had all the recent studies that show us that exercise does absolutely nothing, starvation doesn't help much. I knew all of my life that I was built for famine, that if we had one that you all could eat and I would be just fine. I'm still trying to lose my baby fat and my baby's 45. So this is terribly important to me. I'm glad to be here on the ground floor of it and glad to see how wonderful the interest is in both industry and all scientists to really fund it all. Joe Handelsman is one of the nicest people in addition to being one of the brightest there is. And she has done so much good work in the White House and I'm really proud to be her friend. And as I mentioned, I think I did, Elizabeth Stelpman used to work for me. She was a fellow, and we love her to death, and she's still a part of the Slaughter family over there. That didn't sound very good, did it, Slaughter family? My husband told me once if he had known I was going to amount to anything, we would have used my maiden name. Okay, so I work in Congress. I'm a microbiologist by training. But it was so long ago, I wouldn't want to tell you what we were using in those days and what we knew. But it has stood me in such good stead. When anybody wants to know if there's a scientist in the room, it's me. And when they always write, the only microbiologist in Congress, and it has helped me enormously. And we will all work together in Congress on what we have to do there and use it to the best of our abilities. So we push for strong investments in sciences and then things that we do in our office. And we are still trying to find the answer to overuse of antibiotics because if 30,000 people die a year, we worked 5 years to get the FDA just to get statistics, we might have saved, what, several thousand people if we had been able to get those ahead of time. It's a very slow process, and it shouldn't have been. It shouldn't have taken 14 years to get that resolved. But it certainly is working out now. And I'm very proud of the use of genetics in cancer treatments. But what's happening here is really pushing all the boundaries. I've never seen anything so ready to go. Last night when I was reading all the money that's already been promised for, the interest is in it, I know that this is going to be done quickly and well. And I'm very excited to learn what this study will bring to us. Dr. Francis Collins likes to remind people of the ubiquity of our complex biomes and pointed out to me that in the crook of our elbow is probably the place where more bacteria are gathered. We know they're there, but we don't know enough about what they do. The idea of learning what their purpose is so critical. It's going to be like splitting the atom, I think, when you get all this done, and I'm very excited about it. So this initiative is wonderful. The tools that will be developed have huge implications for basic understanding of how bacteria interact, but also in how we approach medicine as a whole. That is invaluable. For example, the development of precision antibiotics to remove only specific organisms is critically important for the human biome research. But the same precision antibiotic could help fight the continuing antibiotic resistance problem. In food safety, this research could develop finding resistant microbiomes to pathogens like Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter, or things of the past. And they are solutions that both public health and private industry will need to get behind. Or even within the food animal production, as you know, I've told everybody in the world, 80% of all the antibiotics that are produced and sold in the United States are used in animal production. And this number has to be reduced if we're going to make substantial change in antibiotic resistance. In fact, most people tell me not to worry about it. We'll just make more antibiotics. We'll really get to the same fate of the ones we have now if we don't stop that overuse. So I'm very excited about the infinite opportunities that this offers. Now, I've had a chance to meet with so many of you who are the leading people in this field. And a couple months ago, in our office sponsored a congressional briefing on human biomes. It had standing room only. Can you imagine that? A year ago, we wouldn't have been able to find anybody who even wanted to know about it. So understanding that relationship between bacteria and the body, their interactions with us, a question that gets to the very core of understanding biology and even humankind. We're embarking on something quite remarkable here. So I'm excited about your hard work and the eventual outcome and the groundbreaking outcomes of this venture. Thank you so much for letting me be with you this afternoon. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, I'd like to welcome to the stage, or please join me in welcoming to the stage, Martin Blaser from New York University. Come on. Tim Donahue from University of Madison, Wisconsin. Jessica Green from University of Oregon. And also Samantha Joy from the University of Georgia. Take it away, Marty.
If you'd like.
Yeah, that's great. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to begin this portion of the conference. It's terrific to follow Louise Slaughter, who has been a pioneer in all fields microbiologic for decades, and of course, Joe, for everything that she has done to bring us to this moment. It is like commencement. It's graduation and it's commencement. So I have the pleasure of moderating this session. I will introduce our speakers in a moment. And the focus of this session, this hot off the press, is about microbes and the physical environment. It's about the place of the microbes and how to harness the power of microbes to solve important problems that we people are having. So the topics, even in this brief time that you'll hear about, are diverse. They're about remediating oil spills, about improving crops and yields for biofuels, and also to understand about the microbes in our air, in our built environment, and how that affects us. As all of you know, there's enormous breadth to the microbiome. As Joe said, everywhere where there is life on Earth, there are microbes. And of course, that's how it has always been. Stephen Gould reminded us that we live in the age of bacteria, as it has always been and as it always will be. And so it's time for us to begin to study it further so that we can harness the knowledge, the incredible wisdom of the microbes evolved over the eons. So what we hope to do is to use the microbes to help us do our work, to understand their biological, chemical, physical restraints, to understand the mathematics, to understand the ecology of the microbes in relation to all other forms of life. So joining me today are our three panelists who are going to discuss their work and the work in their fields. Our first panelist will be Samantha Joy from the University of Georgia. She will tell us something about the microbiomes in the ocean. Our second panelist will be Dr. Tim Donahue from the University of Wisconsin, and he'll focus on microbes in the soil. And our third panelist, Jessica Green, University of Oregon, so we have a national representation. She'll focus on the air microbes. So we have water, soil, and air. Each of the panelists will make a statement. Then I'm going to moderate a discussion. And if everything goes well, we're going to have time for questions for everybody here, not everybody, but for some people here, and just remember to keep your questions short. So let's begin with Mandy, please.
Good afternoon. So I'd like to share with you some of our results from the Gulf of Mexico. Back in 2010, as you all know, there was an oil spill in the Eastern Gulf, the Macondo blowout, and we were fortunate enough to be one of the first on the scene. And more importantly, we had funding from NOAA to work in the area prior to the oil spill, so we actually had background data. A couple of the most interesting things that we found were that if you dig down into microbial diversity, looking deeper into that 3% that you don't see when you sequence at 97% similarity, we found that using oligotyping, we could actually track a very detailed evolution of microbial ecotypes from Coelia to Cycloclasticus to Alkanivorax. Key hydrocarbon degraders changed dramatically over the course of the spill. And one of the most important discoveries that we made was that the background microbiome, so the background oil degrading community, shifted in response to the OSPA, which isn't a big surprise. The big surprise is that 3 years later, it hadn't shifted back. And that was quite surprising and impressive to us. The second thing that I'll speak briefly about is that we did a laboratory experiment to try and mimic what we saw in the field, and we're able to do that quite well. And again, using oligotyping, this tool to dig deep into microbial diversity, we're able to identify some unique organisms that we didn't really understand what their role in responding to the oil spill was. So I think the lesson I'd like you to take from our work, and that I'll be happy to talk later about in detail to anybody who's interested, is that the natural microbiome in the ocean has the potential to respond to perturbation, not just oil spills, but hurricanes, other environmental disasters such as floods and hypoxia. But what we need to understand better is what the timescale evolution of those processes are, and how the community comes back. Does it come back to the steady state that it was at before the perturbation, or does it go to a new steady state, and how does that affect ecosystem functioning? Thank you.
Thank you. So, I'm Tim Donahue, and I'm going to tell you a story that's come out of work in Great Lakes Bioenergy. Great Lakes Bioenergy is one of three Department of Energy bioenergy research centers that have a mission to produce knowledge needed to convert non-edible or lignocellulosic biomass into fuels and chemicals. So one major bottleneck in achieving this mission is the production of crops that will be needed to fuel the productivity to product pipeline to feed tomorrow's lignocellulosic biorefineries. There has long been an appreciation that soil microbial communities influence plant productivity and provide valuable ecosystem services for humans and animals on the land. Indeed, for over 100 years, farmers have been adding a nitrogen-fixing bacteria to reduce the amount of fertilizer that farmers need to provide high yields of soybean or other so-called leguminous crops. So several years ago, Great Lakes Bioenergy wanted to know how the soil microbial populations would change under different cellulosic crops, under the use of different agricultural practices, including the presence and absence of fertilizer, the use of regional differences in soil chemistry and weather, both local and seasonal variations, including drought, that this industry will face moving forward. In the last year, members of our center at UW-Madison and Michigan State University, in collaboration with researchers around the globe, published what I think are a set of landmark papers analyzing the interplay between biomass crops and soil microbial communities over several growing seasons in the Midwest. They could associate differences in crop yields with changes in soil microbial communities, their potential for fixing nitrogen into ammonia, or to produce an unwanted greenhouse gas like nitrous oxide. This is an important set of findings for several reasons. It provides data to begin to predict and model how cellulosic cropping systems will perform on the land at scale needed for an industry. But these studies are only a first step. To produce cellulosic biomass at the yields we need year after year, we need to identify biomarkers that report on the activities of beneficial or detrimental microbes in the soil, productive plants, or healthy soil, and to understand how environmental factors like climate change or drought impact productivity of cellulosic ecosystems. Only with this information can we then be able to optimize land use for producing food and energy and chemicals while controlling greenhouse gas emissions, preventing a 21st century dust bowl, and providing animal nesting, recreation, and other benefits that we want from these types of activities. So with that, I will stop.
Thank you very much, Tim. Jessica.
Hi, I'm Jessica Green.
And can you hear me now? Great. I study the microbiology of the built environment, where all of you are going to spend 90% of your life, unfortunately. I was trained as a civil engineer, and as a student, we were taught that microbes in the indoor environments were pollutants, and that we could and should model their fate and transport in such a way to get them out of the indoor environment. Today, my colleagues and I at the Biology and Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon and a number of researchers that are here today are having a new line of investigation in the indoor environment where we're discovering that architects and engineers, without knowing it, are designing microbiomes in the indoor environment. Their decisions make a difference to what microbial communities we are coming into contact with. Some of the major findings that we've had is that design choices like ventilation, if you have a mechanically ventilated room like this space right here, you're going to be exposed to more human-associated microbes relative to a naturally ventilated space where you'll be exposed to more outdoor microbes. We've also learned that occupancy and how you design the flow of people and the density of people in the built environment have a really big impact on the indoor microbiome. And what that has done at the Biology Built Environment Center, we wanted to understand the human microbial cloud. If you sit down for a couple of hours in a space and work on your laptop, are you shedding microbes to the indoor environment? And we found that not only do humans emit a large quantity of bacteria from their bodies in the course of a couple of hours, but we also found that there are differences between people, subtle differences but detectable in their human microbial cloud. And this has implications not only for research in the indoor environment and human health, but it also has implications for forensics and also ethics. So where does the human microbiome stop? And can we trace where people have been, even if they haven't touched something in the indoor environment?
Great. So this is just an overview, and I wanted to ask the panelists some questions about this. I'll ask to each of the panelists, but others may want to join in. But before I do this, I just want to mention that Joe and her colleagues had asked that we bring some students here. And I brought two students from my lab, Angel Schulfer, a graduate student, and Alex Swan, an undergraduate student. So this next generation can see this piece of history in the making. So it's very important to pass the baton. So now I'm going to start by asking Mandy. It's likely that oil spills are going to happen again, and despite everything that we do. So how do you think that a microbiome program is going to help you and colleagues come up with the tools to remediate faster next time?
Well, first of all, there's an oil spill right now. Happened yesterday in the Gulf, a small one. But I think the important thing is to understand the background and the baseline. We have a very poor understanding of microbial backgrounds in general, particularly for the ocean. It's huge, 70% of the planet. We have to develop the tools to and the infrastructure to have, you know, real-time sampling. Temporal sampling is a problem. And what the microbiome science teaches us is who the important players are. There was a paper just published earlier this week in Nature Microbiology by Brent Baker's group that showed, you know, some organisms that we would never have even expected to be involved in hydrocarbon degradation were key players in microbial hydrocarbon degradation during the Macondo oil spill. So understanding who the players are, their environmental regulation, how to optimize their activity perhaps, those kinds of things require that we know the important players, and we don't at this point. So gaining that information, having a community of scientists tackling this really complex problem will help us to better understand how the environment is going to respond to oil spills and help us to better help scientists be better involved on the response side with respect to what's good and bad to do in the course of, you know, let nature take its course and maybe they can solve the problem better than humans can.
Yeah. I wonder if we could even imagine a first aid kit.
Exactly. Yeah.
First early response while we're waiting for more definitive answers.
Yeah.
Tim, I wanted to ask you about the explorations of the soil microbiome vis-a-vis the problem of monoculture that's happening all over the world in all forms of agriculture, and how we could use microbiome knowledge to help combat that to some degree.
So that's actually something else that we're studying in the center. We tend to look at agricultural activities across the landscape from low diversity, high input to high diversity, low input systems. And you're absolutely right. Most of our most productive land for agriculture for food is based on low diversity, high input species like corn or soybean. There will be many hundreds of thousands of tons of that kind of biomass that could feed these lignocellulosic biorefineries. But we're actually coming up with data where we would like to suggest to farmers that instead of having empty rows between those crops that are laden with pesticides, we actually can go in there and put grasses that are perennials, that have root structures, that sequester carbon, actually would require less chemicals in those environments, and would actually increase their yield and the value of lignocellulose they would get per acre. That will be an interesting conversation as that data comes out, and farmers will have to consider that in the context of what they have normally done since their grandparents owned the farm and what practices are recommended by agribusiness. But I think that's one big piece. The other big piece is using what I've referred to as marginal lands, which are currently very highly diverse, have good ecosystem services, and good carbon capture, and are polyculture systems in and of themselves.
Yeah, so we'll have to understand the especially for those marginal lands, we'll have to understand the microbiome so we don't despoil them.
That's exactly right.
So, Jessica, I wanted to ask you about something I know that Congresswoman Slaughter is very interested in, and that is antibiotic resistance and antibiotic resistance genes in the built environment. When people have resistant organisms, are they shedding resistant organisms, resistance genes?
They probably are. We haven't quantified that yet, but we are beginning to look at the relationship between antimicrobial compounds in the built environment and dust and antibiotic resistance genes. My postdoc, Erica Hartman, is leading that effort. She's doing a fantastic job, and we are finding that there's a correlation between the diversity and abundance of antibiotic resistance genes and antimicrobial compounds in the indoor environment like triclosan. So figuring out potential health impacts of the indoor microbiomes that we're creating is really important when you consider that in 2050, 70% of humanity is going to be living in cities and urban spaces. So we need to prepare and plan for that from a public health perspective.
I want to ask all of you the question about biomass. This is particularly germane in the air, but it's also relevant to other niches as well. Do we have the tools to deal with samples of low biomass? Will we be able to get the resolution we need? What kind of tools do we need? Anyone?
So I think for ocean-going research, it's a difficult problem in many places. The solution is usually to filter more water. But even that isn't a complete fix, because it's not just low biomass, it's cracking the cells. The extraction efficiency can be quite variable, and there are a lot of organisms that just are resistant to cracking. So the development of really good extraction techniques that are standardized across disciplines, I think, is really important. And for that matter, just standardization of tools and techniques across, you know, soils, oceans, everything is critical, because that'll help us to have a better, you know, continuity across fields. But I think in the ocean, it's something that we deal with all the time, especially in sediments and in the deep biosphere. But the key is efficient extraction technologies, and I think we're getting to the point where we can handle these low biomass ecosystems fairly efficiently.
Tim?
So I would echo everything that was just said about the oceans and reinforce it quite a bit, either in the soils or in the fermenter where we're making fuels. We need techniques to be able to do all of those things at the various scales that we need. The soil prevents additional challenges of having the chemistry of the surface of soil particles and the nooks and crannies. So within any community, there's going to be nooks and crannies, but the physical environment of the soil prevents, I think, unique challenges that we need to be able to address as we move forward.
Jessica?
Yeah, the built environment is a very low biomass environment, but we've made a lot of progress in analyzing low biomass samples. What I think is needed to really scale research, science, and technology in all of these areas is sensors that you can deploy, so handheld sensors where you can get real-time microbiome information in any environment. Right now, the turnaround times make it really difficult to infer what's driving community composition and the implications of that. So that's what I think would help probably everyone in this room.
So I think we have time for some questions. I hope people in the audience might have questions for our panelists about any of these topics mentioned or others relating to microbiome and physical environment. We could always throw in human health. Yes. Well, just wait for 1 second until you get the microphone.
Mentioned the built environment and how we shed our microorganisms. What about the other directions? What can we pick up from the built environment and how can this impact our lifestyles and health?
Yeah, so we're still working on, and many people in the field are working on understanding that interaction between what humans give off to the indoor environment and what we pick up. So at the Biology and Built Environment Center, we're starting to do research where we're touching surfaces and also looking at microbial exchange just through the microbial cloud, not only of humans, but also plants and dogs.
Down in front.
So this kind of relates to the antibiotics in the soil. Because we're using so many antibiotics in cattle, for example, and we use the manure often to fertilize the soil, do you find that it sterilizes the soil?
I don't know that I have the technical knowledge to give you an answer to that about the effects of antibiotic leach from manure into the soil.
Mm-hmm. But
there's somebody in the room who could follow up with that.
But I will tell you that those antibiotics move from the manure to the soil to the watershed. Mm-hmm. And we can detect antibiotics in riverine waters in the United States and in China in high concentrations and in urban water supplies in China in extremely high concentrations. So this is an unintended consequence. Mm-hmm.
And also in wastewater treatment plants, there's a large accumulation of antibiotics and antimicrobial compounds that in some places around the world, that sludge is put out to dry and it becomes airborne and it gets into people's homes. And typically people that are maybe don't have the economic means to live somewhere else.
Great. We have a question there.
Dr. Joey mentioned how after our oil spill, there was a change in dynamics and maybe a new steady state. This is human-made somehow. What happened natural phenomena like hurricanes, like droughts? There's a feeling that there's a chilling, or there is data that there's a change, and maybe a new steady state is generated as well, or no?
Yes, that's a good question. So we've done work with respect to droughts and hurricanes as well, and you do see community shifts. It's you know, we started this 10 years ago when it was very difficult to document those shifts. Oligotyping didn't exist then. And when we first did our study with drought and salinity intrusion in coastal embayments, it was really difficult to see those changes. I want to go back and reanalyze that data now that we can do oligotyping. But in the Gulf of Mexico, hypoxic zone, the dead zone in the Gulf, you see dramatic shifts that occur seasonally there as the system goes from, you know, oxic to anoxic. And that happens every year as the hypoxia develops. So the system in that case responds on a sort of a seasonal cycle to a seasonal perturbation. After a hurricane, there wasn't a whole lot of work done in the Gulf looking at the microbial community after, let's say, Hurricane Katrina in 2005. But I would anticipate that hurricanes cause, you know, those rapid perturbations. The question is, how fast does it come back and where does it come back to? For oil spills, you know, the Gulf of Mexico has tremendous amounts of natural seepage, yet that massive in infusion of oil and gas to the system caused what appear to be long-term persistent changes that we've yet to see relax back to baseline, and we're up through about 2014 in the analysis of those data. So it's unclear how long it'll take that system to recover. But I think these perturbations drive change. The question is, do those changes impart different function?
Yeah.
Yeah, Marty, I'll take you up on your offer. In thinking about the human microbiomes, what is really exciting you these days? What are sort of the correlations, the hypotheses that you're just dying to test if you had the right tools?
Well, I should pay you now. As you know, I'm very interested in early life, in how the microbiome forms from the moment of birth, maybe even before birth, because early life is the critical time in which humans develop, and we develop our immunity, our metabolism, our cognition. And the question is, how are we perturbing that, and can we measure that? And can we remediate that, like the oil spills? Ed.
Thank you. Ed Young at The Atlantic. We've heard from Joe that one of the core ideas for this initiative is bring parallels between all these disparate work going on in all these disparate microbiomes, because many of the principles that operate in one system apply to another. And so you four represent water, earth, air, and gastrointestinal fire. Is this a case of, are we moving from a case where you're doing work in separate systems and then looking post hoc at the similarities between them, or will you actually get to a point where the results and principles derived from studying one area can be genuinely used to predict or understand what's happening in another?
Panelists?
I could take a shot. I think there's certainly parallels between all of these ecosystems. They all involve water, even if it's only water vapor. And so there are things that we can certainly learn from studying, the manufactured, built microbiome versus the ocean microbiome. And I think that, once we get, I could imagine in a world of bioinformatics heaven where we have tools where we can plug our sequences in and see how it maps onto the larger dynamic of the Earth microbiome. And I think that would just be an incredible place to be. We're not there yet, but I think the power of this initiative is that it's going to help push us there. And it's going to give us a warp drive for microbiome science that we've just not had here. And I'm really excited about the possibilities.
Yeah, I'll reinforce that. I think one of the many great things about this initiative moving forward is its potential to allow convergence and get people who are thinking about similar issues in their own little part or large part of the planet, be it the earth, be it the air, the soil, animals, or humans, talking to each other, as well as getting people from different disciplines. So the answer, for example, the answer that we just heard about how the aquatic ecosystems change with temperature and whatnot. I could tell you a story in a paper that's out for review of how if you were running a biorefinery and you were taking one crop in a drought year, it wouldn't make a difference. But if you were bringing a different crop in and you were fermenting it with one organism, you would need to shut your plant down because you would get no fuel out of it. Because there is changes in the soil and the plant physiology that's producing toxins that shut down biofuel microbes. So these are the types of things that we need to be thinking about as we're really moving these ideas forward.
Yes. I have a brief answer. I think that we're all working in two major themes, data analytics and biotechnology. And regardless of the study system or the specific questions that you're answering, we all are making progress in both of those areas, and we need both of those areas to advance our respective fields, and we're learning from one another as we do that.
And some of the themes behind this are fundamental chemistry, biophysics, principles of ecology, mathematics. Just last night we were working with mathematicians who work on a completely different system to help us understand changes in animal microbiome. Questions? Yeah.
Regarding the oceans, is there any ability to look at historical repositories such as icebergs to evaluate how over-harvesting of food sources or perhaps the globalization of shipping has impacted the current normal state of the oceans?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Actually, both icebergs and sediments provide a natural repository for biosignatures. They're called biomarkers. And you can take those molecular markers, and it's just like a lens through time. You can look back through history and understand how the system has changed. With respect to shipping channels, we know that shipping has had a tremendous impact on the distribution of species across the planet, invasive species in particular. So certainly that is important and something that could be tracked. But in terms of geologic history, I'm a geobiologist as well as a microbiologist, and understanding how the microbial community of this planet has changed over time is something that we can certainly get at with tools that we have in hand, and the microbiome initiative will allow us to dig even deeper and look at more subtle, perhaps sort of use microbes as sentinels for change over time and long time scales of that.
Hi, you've commented on the ability of antibiotics to shape the microbiome, and I was wondering if you could also comment on the ability of bacteriophage to shape the microbiome or contribute to microbiome resistance in each of your environments.
What's the start?
Me again. Viruses are critical in shaping microbial communities, and we know, we haven't published it yet, but we know that with respect to oil spills and other perturbations, you know, once you have a bloom of a microbial population in response to disturbance, what happens naturally next is their viruses bloom and take those organisms out, and then something else moves in. So I think a lot of the ecological succession we see in natural environments result from boom or bust cycles that are driven by viral dynamics. So understanding viruses, you know, it's a critical part of the microbiome that is not nearly as big as it needs to be. I think I looked at like 3% of all microbiome research is viruses, and I was shocked by that number. I thought it would be much bigger than that. I could be off a little bit, but in a quick search that I did, that's about what I saw.
Obviously a predator-prey problem.
Well, I was just going to say I'm really happy you asked that question, because as you did, I realized we got a half an hour into this and no one had mentioned the word virus or phage, and that's an underrepresented term. And not to reinforce what was just said, the viral world is something that we have stolen, is something that we call dark matter, quite frankly, a term that we've stolen from the physicist. There's this great unknown out there, especially if you look at these large viral genomes that are you know, populated with open reading frames that look like they came from Mars, and so it's really hard to, unfortunately, to answer your question, because there's so much unknown about what is enhanced in viral genomes that hopefully this initiative will help us provide answers to.
We know very little about the built environment virome. And the reason for that is largely due to technical challenges. So when you're working in a low biomass environment, metagenomic analysis or specifically targeting the virome has been a challenge. And that's something that I feel like we could make great progress on.
So this session has now run out of time, or almost run out of time, just enough time for me to thank the panelists, to thank you all. You can see that there are exciting things going on, and this is really a kind of first installment, and we are grateful to the federal and private initiative that's going to move this frontier forward. So thank you.
Thank you.